Why do I conduct my show on this manner? Mondo!
Sweet mother of God, what is the holdup?
Eleanor!
Once again, something wonderful in my life has been turned into a giant crap fest.
Mondo!
Got a little bit more cock for you here.
Eleanor!
Bowtie boy got the big snaggeroonie.
Mondo!
Oh, six of my nipples are tingling.
Eleanor!
See why America loves him so much?
Mondo!
I'd like to smash you in the face with my shillelagh.
Eleanor!
I have no idea what's going on.
Mondo!
He was lying.
He said he never tells a lie.
He was lying when he said that.
Eleanor!
I want a cup.
Well, could you spell that?
C-U-P. I want to see you. Oh, my God.
I know nothing. Nothing.
Stomach batteries to power. Turbines to speed.
For God's sake, strap yourself down.
That's right. It's the show your bosses don't want you to listen to. The show that's going to tell you the truth about what's going on in the workplace. So wake the hell up. It's the Cup of Joe radio show. I am your not-so-humble host, Joe Vecchio, the voice of the working man, the voice of the radical middle, and the voice of those who have been unvoiced by the anti-worker policies of the Bush administration and its corporate allies. Our engineer, Sock Puppet Sam, is here! And we've got a lot of stuff to talk about, but first, Sam, give us the URL for the site.
That's cupojoe.blogspot.com.
And the email address.
joevec@bellsouth.net.
All right, I want to welcome all of my fans listening in at the White Rose Society. That's whiterosesociety.org. My good friend Ben Birch hosting my archives there. And, of course, all my fans at rantsradio.com listening in on Thursdays and Sundays.
Okay, it is Sunday. What is it, the 5th? 6th? 6th. Sunday, February 6th. Super Bowl Sunday. And we're all here in the fabulous Studio Al. And I'm here with Rick. Hi, Rick.
Hey.
Ravishing Rick is here. And we have another...
Ravishing Rick?
Ravishing Rick.
Like no, it's more like Rambling Rick.
Rambling Rick? Well, I'm rambling around.
Rambling Rick.
You're a rambling Rick from Georgia. Did you go to Georgia Tech?
I did not,
okay.
No.
But you could be a rambling Rick from Georgia Tech.
I suppose.
And we also have Clayton. How do you pronounce your last name again?
Linhart.
I kept saying Lionheart. That's what I wanted to say. Lionheart. Clay Linhart. But you said that's what the original... meaning is.
Right, from Germany, that's right.
Now, Clay is he's my associate with the DeKalb County, Georgia Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm.
And Rick, I don't think we've mentioned this before, but you are with the North Fulton.
I'm with the North Fulton. I'm with the State Dems. I'm all over the place.
You're all over the friggin' place, man. You are just all over. And Clay here got me, helped me get the software for... some desktop publishing work that I'll be doing. In fact, we'll be working on the newsletter together for the DeKalb Democrats. So I get to put those screens. How are you guys doing today? Pretty good?
Yeah, pretty good.
Outstanding.
It's Super Bowl Sunday. You guys big football fans?
Pretty big?
You are. I know you are.
I like football.
And you said you watch a Super Bowl and that's really about it.
That's about it.
It seems to be more true that the left-wingers do not talk about sports as much, or not as big sports fans. I mean, the other people I know in the election reform group, they don't really talk about sports at all. In fact, some of them rather look on sports with disdain. You know, how can you watch something so trivial and so stupid? I mean, I grew up with baseball. I like football. Football's okay. When I was growing up, baseball was like my religion. In fact, we've been watching the Ken Burns great baseball documentary.
You're from New York, right?
Yeah, and that's where
you the Mets, Yankees.
I was the Mets. Yeah, I was a Mets fan. I watch the Braves now. I like the Braves now. There's a good year. Your cell phone is clicking my speaker again there, Rick.
Yeah, off it goes.
Rick's got a cell phone, and every now and then it makes my speaker do really, really goofy things. I haven't been able to figure out how it works.
I'm wondering what it does to my head.
I don't know.
You know,
it would explain why you come here, though.
Why I get lost coming here all the time.
You took a back way, and I tell you, you don't take it a back ways if you don't know what you own. At any rate, what I was saying was in New York City, baseball was not a sport. It was a friggin' religion. And there used to be, in fact, we just watched the tape that we just watched on Ken Burns was the one about in the 50s, New York was the capital of baseball. I mean, there was a New York team that was in or won the World Series every year in the 50s, between the Yankees and the Giants and the Dodgers, which were the three teams. And I found out there were some people who didn't know that the Dodgers used to be in Brooklyn and the Giants used to be in New York. They didn't live in a time that they've always been in San Francisco.
The Bums.
Yeah. So, and my dad used to tell me stories about Ebbets Field and stuff. And, of course, I was way too young for that. I was born in 62, so I got to miss out on all of that. But that 62 was the year the Mets started. And so I grew up a Mets fan because we grew up in a National League neighborhood, except for Alphonse Castelli and Kevin Verdina, who were the block bullies and the block assholes. They were Yankee fans because they cared about winning, and that's all they cared about. They had no love of sport. But today is Super Bowl Sunday. And our boys, the Falcons, got beat 2 weeks ago. And I hate the fact that they wait 2 weeks. I wish they'd just do it the next week and get it over with. But our boys, the Falcons, lost to Philadelphia, who's playing in the Super Bowl against New England. But left-wingers in general, like I said, are not sports fans. Usually when they are sports fans, they're baseball fans, because baseball is much more of an intellectual sport than football is. And right-wingers in particular love football. Because they see that as an analogy for life.
You know, war.
It's war. Well, it's more than war. In fact, George Carlin's great. You may be thinking about that. George Carlin had that great comparison between baseball and football, and all the differences. And football is always talked about in military terms. You know, football is baseball is played on a diamond in a park, the baseball park. Football is played on a gridiron in a stadium, War Memorial Stadium. You know, and of course they have Soldier Field in Chicago. But there's a different attitude about baseball and football. Football is much more emotional, much more, you know, rah rah, sis boom bah, and very militaristic. You know, it's a technological 20th century sport as opposed to a pastoral 19th century sport. But the right wingers love it because to them it's emblematic of how life should be. You play well, you get rewarded, you win games, and you play badly, you lose games. And it's not always the case that way in real life. I mean, real life and football are two completely things. Football is played within specific rules and specific bounds. Life has no real rules and bounds. The only, you know, we agree to the rules that we have, and we try to live within them, but it's perfectly easy to go around them. And that's where the problems lie. And the Republicans are kind of like a team that openly advocates cheating. And whose idea of winning is to, you know, take out the other opponents so that they can just, you know, do whatever they feel like.
It is all about winning these days, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the ends justify the means. Might makes right. And that really bothers me sometimes that Democrats don't look at it from the same point of view. I mean, I get so many people, when I talk about fighting back, they're like, oh, we don't want to become just like them. So look, man, you either have to adapt to the situation or you're going to get destroyed. We can't throw forward passes because they're throwing forward passes, and that's just plain wrong. You really should go out there and run it, Wall, like we did in the old days, and that's the only way you should play football. And everybody who says otherwise is just plain wrong.
Well, maybe, Joe, they ought to think outside the box a bit more.
Well, they don't. That's the problem. And
I mean, it's not just about winning, you know, and stomping back.
Mm-hmm.
It's about thinking outside the box. It's a Martin Luther King thing.
Mm-hmm.
If Martin Luther King had fought in the same way as the sheriffs of Birmingham, Alabama, I don't think the movement would have succeeded.
Well, did the movement succeed at all, though? I mean,
well, it succeeded in a lot of ways, I think.
I mean, how did we get our freedom from England? We didn't discuss it nice and neat with them. We had to take up arms against it. We didn't defeat the Nazis by, you know, being diplomatic and being nonviolent. We had to go over there and kick their friggin' asses. I mean, yeah, granted, I agree the nonviolent approach can be called for and works sometimes, but
no, I'm just saying, think outside the box. Yeah. That was a thinking outside the box that King did.
Mm-hmm.
And the Democrats have to do that, too. I don't think they can be outdo the Republicans at their own game.
But you don't have to play their game, but you have to understand what their strategies are. And there are some things that we can do that we can emulate what they do. For example, in sports terms, the Republicans build up a farm system. They find people who, you know, they'll train. These are talented people. They'll train and they'll teach them in their mold how to do things, how to phrase things, how to say things. They've been doing this for 30 years and they're very, very good at it. We can do the same thing. There's no reason we can't do the same thing. I mean, it's okay to fight back. It's okay to hit hard. You know what I'm saying? I mean, we can't be, in football terms, if a wide receiver comes over the middle and tries to catch a ball. It's perfectly all right to knock the shit out of that guy. I mean, so long as you do it cleanly. Don't hit him with the helmet. Don't hit him in the nuts. You know, a good, solid, clean hit. That intimidates them. And sometimes you have to do that. Some, you know, it's just like with businesses. If you want to get businesses to reform, you can't just ask them politely and see if they want to do it. No, 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 no. You got to put a gun to their head. You're going to pay these wages. You're going to have these working conditions. Because if you don't do that, they're not going to do it.
I see Clay nodding his head over
there.
Oh,
yes. Oh, yeah.
Hey, you're a knock-em-in-the-head guy.
Do you feel... No, but I totally agree with the sentiment of, you know, we can't just, like, give in to businesses and just kind of let them decide how our society is going to be. You know...
Well, I agree with that, too. But, you know, I agree with fighting. It's just how do you fight?
Right.
And, you know, does fighting mean that you do illegal things at the Secretary of State level? Right? Do you rig elections? Do you try to take over the computers like Diebold did and that kind of thing? I don't agree with that at all.
I think that's way outside of bounds.
No, I agree that's way outside of bounds. What we need to do is set up a system where the actual result is based upon the actual vote. I mean... We should set up the ground rules and say that everybody agrees on it. Said, listen, this is an area that both of us need to just agree that this has got to work. We have to work within the system. But the Republicans don't understand that. All they care about is winning, and to them, the ends do justify the means. They'll go out there and do anything. And I mean, you look at how they operate. Okay, Vince Lombardi, the great coach for the Green Bay Packers in the '60s. His favorite phrase was, winning isn't everything, but it's the only thing that matters. Now, he was talking about football. He wasn't talking about life. You know. But we can emulate their type of team because they didn't win by playing dirty. They won because they were talented, because they were disciplined, because they had good leadership, and they were a class act. They hit hard. Nobody thinks that the Green Bay Packers were anything but a hard-hitting, very tough football team with great football players. And that's something that we can emulate. Go out there. Push some people around sometimes if you have to. I've talked about this before in the labor movement. We've got a lot of stuff through politics. Sure, we got actually more stuff because we were willing to go out into the streets with baseball bats and fight for what we believed in. And the Republicans are willing to do that, and we're not. And a lot of it is because people have this kind of, it's got to be pure, it's got to be, you know, totally above board all the time. And you can't always be that way.
Well, it's also strategic because if you look at what's happened to the Democrats, they've become a party of Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And they fought the battle for the presidency. They didn't fight any of the other battles in the states.
Right.
And they fought that battle in, what, 11 states altogether?
Yeah.
And now maybe that has to change. Maybe they have to get back to what they talk about all the time, which is politics is all local.
Right. And I think that's one of the things that I hope Dr. Dean, if he does indeed become the new head of the Democratic National Committee, which I think we all are happy about.
What's the word on that so far?
It looks like it's a done deal.
Yeah.
Because he's – in fact, I talked to I had a meeting. There was a meeting of the DCAP Dems the other night, and they had Bobby Kahn there, who was the chairman of the Georgia Democratic Party. And he was asked directly by someone, who are you guys supporting for chairman of the DNC? And he said straight out Howard Dean. Mm-hmm. And if he's getting the Georgia delegates, he got endorsements from the Florida delegates. The official vote tally, he's got more than enough than what he needs, you know, of the not endorsements so much, but like a poll of the people who are actually doing the vote. So it's beginning to look like pretty much a done deal. And this is not a situation where an Iowa thing can happen because there's only so many people who can vote. But Dr. Dean understands that. And I remember when Rick, we met at the meeting where Governor Dean was, and they asked him what the Southern strategy would be. And the first words out of his mouth were what?
Show up.
Exactly. John Kerry had no – now, I can understand that to a certain extent. I mean, I get so pissed off at Southerners down here because I feel not all of them, but there's enough of them out there so that this state is really a lost cause. And I really need to – I really think that while the Democrats need to work towards a day, then we could retake these states. For the moment, they're just a lost cause for us. Because so many people are just been brainwashed by this propaganda machine that the Republicans have. It's very, very difficult to overcome the image that Democrats have had. You know, I saw one that said the Democratic Party of the United States had a picture of a little crying baby in there. You know, and every time – and that's the type of thing I'm talking about. We have the impression that we're just whiny losers. And we didn't used to be that way. I mean, Harry Truman made no bones about hitting back and hitting hard. He said, you hit hard, you hit them hard all the time, and you never apologize for who you are or what you're doing. Well, that was Teddy Roosevelt. My wife said, walk softly and carry a big stick.
And he was Republican, but actually.
But he was a progressive.
But he was a progressive.
In fact, he was the first real liberal president, because liberalism really hadn't been around until then. It didn't become a word and phrase until the 30s when Roosevelt and the New Deal people took over. But he was a progressive. He was in favor of environmental laws. He was in favor of workplace laws and stuff like that. In fact, he fought with the Republican Party based on those issues. And if he hadn't been stupid after he got elected the second time and said that that was the last time he was going to run, then he could have been elected to a third and a fourth or maybe even a fifth term, because he was still very young and he was still very, very popular. So he screwed up there. He screwed up there. But it's
this kind of goes back to your question of, you know, should we kind of – what should we do exactly? And running for a third office, I don't think is, you know, what should be done. I think, you know, yes, it would have been good for progressive, you know, issues, but is that – what's good for society? It's good to have turnover.
In Teddy's case, he would have put in a lot more stuff. I mean, he created most of the national parks that we had, and he really helped out with workplace safety issues, because it was really, really bad. People think it's bad now, and it is bad now, but this is nothing compared to the way it was a century ago.
Oh, and yes, and he started cleaning up the monopolies as well.
Mm-hmm.
Way back when.
That's right.
Because I think he wasn't strictly down party lines or down party philosophies. He was out there trying to do what he believed was right.
Right, right. And the Democrats back then were still pretty much the party of slavery, the party of the Southerners. They didn't really become the Democrats we know until the 30s, 1932. And of course, you still had the Democratic big machines like Tammany Hall in New York that were capable of producing, you know, politicians, because mostly they got a lot of immigrants to sign up to vote. So, but I agree with you that there are some methods that we should not employ. I mean, we're against torture. We don't need to do that. We don't need to pay the media to write favorable stuff about us like the Republicans are doing. Mm-hmm. We don't feel the need to try to destroy the Republicans and the Republican voters, because that's apart from being just plain wrong, it's unnecessary and damaging to our own cause in the long run. But like I said, if their receiver comes out in the middle of the field, you knock the shit out of them. You make them know that if you try something, we're going to be here to attack you. And then it's just a question of...
To call you on it.
And it's like, if we do that, then they'll be less willing to do that. Or at the very least, they'll at least have the courage to come out there and say something and take that hit.
Well, let me ask you this. If you do that... Now, you have to be willing from time to time, I imagine, to do that. But if you do that in the same way that the Republicans have, which is to hit often and hard, do you not encourage them to just do the same thing again and perpetuate the problem?
The only
in other words, can civility return to politics,
if ever?
I don't know if it ever will totally, because there's always going to be differences of opinion and people have different visions of what the world should be. But what it does is it makes them, A, think twice about doing it, and it makes them understand that there is a price to be paid when you want to make an attempt at something. And really, the only reason they do it, to address what you were saying, the only really reason they do stuff like that is because they can get away with it. If they couldn't get away with it, then they wouldn't do it so much. I mean, Bill Clinton said that. They asked him, how are they able, you know, why are they doing all this stuff? And he said, because they get away with it. If somebody stood up to them like a bully, you know, like the bullies that they are, if somebody stood up to them, then they wouldn't be able to get away with it like they do.
So how can the Democrats get a backbone?
How can they get a backbone?
Yeah, we need a backbone, don't you think? We didn't have much of a backbone. Every time they attacked us, we kind of bent over and cowered away.
Well, a lot of it has to just do with the leadership. And it comes up to another thing that Dr. Dean talked about. He said, in Washington, it's all about knowing what your place is. And the Democrats have settled into a second-place mentality, and they basically prefer to stay there than to go, you know, take a chance on going even lower. I look at it this way from the point of view of sports again, since this is kind of like the whole thing. People would rather root for a team, even if they lost, they would rather root for a team that was actually standing there and doing something, you know, and standing up for what they believed in and fighting it and trying hard to win the game. If they know you're trying to win the game, you know, we can't be satisfied with losing, because I'll tell you something. In politics, there's no such thing as second place. There's absolutely no such thing as second place. I mean, going back to the Vince Lombardi quote, and that's, and this is the total truth for politics. Winning isn't everything, but it's the only thing that matters. You either win and have power, or you lose and have none. Period. That's it.
But some guys out there continue to inspire us.
Well, sure.
I mean, like Dean continues to inspire. I don't think Kerry really continues to inspire.
No.
Right? I mean, he's a good man, and he's decent, and he's got a lot of good ideas, but he doesn't inspire like Mr. Dean does.
And he also, I don't think he understands the nature of the enemy that we're fighting. I mean, you know, he was a great soldier in Vietnam, and he did what he had to do, and I don't understand why he didn't turn the strategy that he used on the Viet Cong onto the Republicans. Turn all the boats into the shore, get as close as you can, and blow the crap out of them. And I don't understand why he didn't do that in the election, and why he fell over so quickly to not, you know, sue in Ohio, or to just concede and say, hey, it's over, you know, whatnot. I really don't think he was up to that. But granted, I don't think anybody could have been up to that. Dr. Dean would not have won that election either. I think this was one that we kind of sort of had to concede to them, because we don't have the kind of machine that they do. And even without the machine that they do, we still did pretty damn good. I think Kerry did very well, as much as well as could be expected, considering, you know, what he was up against. You know what I mean? I think he did a great job, but he doesn't have that desire that is needed. And not just by himself, but throughout the entire Democratic machine. And what is the big thing they do? They hire these big advisors. Who's that guy's name? Bob Schrum? You know, and they figure it's like hiring a really good, cool assistant coach and figuring they don't have to take care of it. And another thing they do that pisses me off is that they don't do any scouting of talent. That is, somebody comes to volunteer, they won't try to figure out what their skills are, what they do, what they're good at, where they can be best used. Oh, there you go, stuff envelopes. Don't bother asking about, you know, how else they can help the party. Go out and stuff envelopes. Clay, when I came to the communications committee meeting, and I'm on the communications committee, both Clay and I, I was pretty straightforward about certain things, wasn't I, at that first committee meeting? You know, I spoke out a lot of things. Mm-hmm. And I talked about running the newsletter, which I don't know if it was apparent to you, but that was the thing I was most concentrating on. Mm-hmm. And I discussed a little bit with you on the side about, you know, what I thought should be the layout and the look of it. And then when you first saw what I put together, what was your reaction?
Something I don't think I've told you is I designed the layout myself.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm thinking,
I saw that and I thought it was a good layout.
Well, thanks. But I was thinking, you know, oh my God, we're duplicating effort here.
Mm-hmm.
That was my reaction.
Yeah. But when you saw, and I'm not talking about, you know, that so much, but I'm just talking about when you saw what I had thrown together.
Uh-huh.
What was your reaction? What did you think of it? I mean, did you think that was a pretty good deal?
Yeah, I thought it was pretty good.
When we talked about it, you sound like a little surprised, like you weren't expecting me to come up with something like that. And you also mentioned when you first heard the show.
Well, the show, more than anything, I was really surprised by the show.
Mm-hmm. Now, and your question was, how come I'm not making any money off of this? My question is, why aren't other Democrats looking at stuff? And I'm not the only one who's doing things like this. Why aren't the other Democrats? This is a guy who's putting together a radio show. We could make use of him. You know, why don't the Democrats do that? And that's what I'm saying. And that's what really pisses me off, because I go in to help volunteer and to do things, and I'll go ahead and stuff envelopes. Well, okay, but anybody can do that. Look, I can do this, I can do this, I can do this. No, that's all we want you to do. When I went to the environmental group that was hiring people, and there's a group called US PIRG, P-I-R-G, and all they want is people to do canvassing. They just assume that everybody's got to start that way and work their way up. And there were some people you just look at and say, no, you can't, this person has other skills.
It's a Waffle House theory.
It's a Waffle House theory.
You got to start behind the counter.
Yeah. But the thing about it is, you know, you go into different organizations, and unless you're willing, I don't know what it takes to get in on the upper end for these people and what they do. But it's one of the things that I talked about in my article, Smartass and High, Mr. Smartass and Mr. High Horse, where you got a lot of these Democratic guys who make a lot of money and are used to making a lot of money and don't understand, you know, and they assume anybody who doesn't make that kind of money is just a dumb, menial. Now, look, I just got a high school education. You wouldn't know it from talking to me, but I'm not very well educated at all. But I've got a lot of different skills. Nobody in the Democratic Party has ever asked me, well, what can you do to help? You know, what skills do you have? And, oh, we can use you doing that. They just say, nope, do this. Keep your mouth shut. And, you know, we'll do all the thinking for you. And it's like, I can't deal with that. And if they had more of that, they had more of the attitude that the Republicans have over talent, they say, hey, this guy's writing good shit. You know, it may be all lies, but we don't care about lies. You know, I mean, we don't have to lie. We don't have to do it in that way. But the Republicans say, this is good shit. This guy writes really well, and it affects a lot of people. Let's make up a whole new fucking magazine for him. Let's make up a whole new magazine and give him a forum to write his stuff. And then we can get him on the TV shows, and we can get him on the radio and all that stuff. And the Republicans do that. And those people wind up making, I mean, some of them make a lot of money. Some of them don't make that much. But they at least make enough money so that they don't have to worry about, you know, food and rent and stuff like that. They can concentrate on it full time. And I get into arguments with Democrats about this shit all the time.
Well, that's the problem, I think, with the Democrats in a lot of ways, is they define the stakes from above.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and everybody out there is a stakeholder.
Right.
Everybody who belongs or claims to be a Democrat is a stakeholder.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason I'm part of the Democrats may be a whole lot different than the reason Clay is part of the Democrats.
Right.
And the Fulton County Democrats may be a whole lot different than the DeKalb County Democrats, or even the North Fulton Democrats from the South Fulton Democrats, mm-hmm. and how they approach everything. And so how do you bring it all together?
It's like herding cats, man.
It is. It's like herding cats. And you've got to find ways to get people involved at ways that brings out the most enthusiasm.
Sure. Well, along this thing, my take on the situation is a little bit different. I think what has happened is people in the DeKalb County Democrats value kind of initiative and people taking it on themselves. So they don't kind of invite you to do something or encourage you to do something. They are more interested in people volunteering and starting it themselves.
Well, you can volunteer, and that's fine. But the thing about it is they should at least, you know, question you, talk to you, and see what you can do. I mean, I went on the communications committee, and, you know, we talked about setting up the website, and I said one of the first things that we need to put up a blog on the website, which a lot of people misunderstand what blogs are, especially the old-time politics. And she was, like, totally against it. No, we're not going to have a damn blog. Everybody's doing a damn blog. But she misunderstands the purpose of it. You know, it's just a quick way of getting, hey, we got a meeting over here. This is what's going on. It doesn't have to be this big, long, you know, thing like what Atrios does or what Daily Coast does. No, just, you know, we're going to have a meeting here. And it just makes it easier for people to post this stuff. And plus, if you have a commentary stuff, it allows for more interaction among things. And she's obviously not very computer, or at least as far as this is concerned, computer savvy in that extent.
I think you're right. In her defense, if you don't mind, I think she's trying to get the fundamentals done and make sure that we do all the other areas that need to get done.
One thing
at a time. And I don't know about Fulton, but in DeKalb County, I mean, the party was in shambles at the beginning of the year because, I won't go into the history, but it's basically a new party. It's new people. It's a very different thing. We're trying to get everything done.
Right. This is an important position that we're doing, Clay.
Well, it's interesting how I think the parties have evolved over the course of the last presidential campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the presidential campaign that made it happen, I believe.
Right.
Because I started going to North Fulton Democrats in maybe, April.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd have 10 people there. Now we have 100 people. And it's after the election.
Yes.
And so what has happened is that somehow along the way, there has been a re-energization of the Democratic Party, and these people have been, you know, North Fulton Democrats. They had 10 people for 2 years or 3 years, and then so, and you were, I think you were part of it. They didn't have anybody. They didn't have anybody in there, but they were this little club that meets and talks about Democratic issues and occasionally goes out and canvasses or whatever. But now they've got 100 or 150 or 1,000 people, names to draw upon. They're not entirely sure what to do.
Right.
Yeah. And so they're in the process of figuring out their own organizations. And
that's
hopefully they will do some of the things you're suggesting, which is to try to draw out the talents of the people who are, in fact, have got things to give.
Right. And I think that's all. Well, obviously it's because John Kerry lost. And I've said this before. While I'm obviously not happy to have George Bush for another 4 years and his administration, in a way, I'm glad that Kerry lost. In a way, I'm glad that Kerry did lose, because if Kerry had won, so many people would have just declared victory and just not gotten involved. And I think that's what happened with Clinton, too. Clinton won, and he was a very popular president. And people just said, oh, we've got the Democratic Party, and that's all we need to do. And of course, the old-time leaders were unwilling to change their ways. Listen, we'll continue on with this. Let's take a little break, and we'll talk more about this issue and some other issues. Sam, play us out.
We'll be right back with more of the Tucker Joe Radio Show.
Trouble was, that thing took off as much on euphoria as on rocket fuel, because the public understood it as a great adventure. And how many great adventures are you going to pay for when the plot's the same every time? So the taxpayer lost interest, and Apollo became this. And before you say good, waste of money, in the same period, American women spent the same amount of money on cosmetics. It was lack of understanding and the scientific reason behind Apollo that killed it. That and the desire we all seem to have developed for novelty. That's one of the effects of living with a high rate of change like we do, that desire for novelty. But it carries a price. More novelty, less understanding. More wrong attitudes towards things, like what happened here. We've arrived at a point where, as somebody said, if you understand something today, it must be obsolete. And that puts us in various kinds of cleft stick. On the one hand, a rate of change so high nobody can keep up with it. And on the other, industry geared to high turnover, novelty, planned obsolescence, so that if you stop making the new models every year and people hang on to the old model they've always had, what happens to the jobs of the people who used to make the new model every year? Again, on the one hand, we have a technological network that keeps us alive, but because every part of that network is interdependent on every other part, it's vulnerable to failure by one bit. That power station relay blacked out northeastern America in 1965. On the other hand, it's only because that network exists that we can draw on power and raw materials from other places when we need them and keep our industries going, whatever. And yet, those industries use up precious raw materials and cause high levels of pollution. Unacceptable? Those are the very problems that stimulate research into cleaner, safer, more unlimited forms of energy that will benefit everybody, not just industry. And so, production line style living grows, and with it the dissatisfaction and the alienation that many people feel in a world that gets more instant, plastic, identical. And yet it's only in that kind of world that many people can have things that they couldn't have if the world wasn't like that. And if you're one of those have-nots now, that's just what you want to happen. And who could blame you? So it looks likely that the rate of change is going to become more confusing as the avalanche of things that make our lives more comfortable, more push-button, grows. But parallel with that increase in the things that we can see around us goes an increase in invisible innovations, in the things where you need a high degree of specialized knowledge just to begin to understand them. Areas like genetic engineering, radioactive fuel, new drugs, better poisons. Areas that are likely to have a more profound effect on our future than a super squeezy bottle of detergent. And it's in those areas that the man in the street feels most impotent. He knows they're going on, but he doesn't know enough to get in there and help with the decisions that they demand. So is it a case that never have so many people understood so little about so much? Or maybe I'm wrong. Maybe when you see something like this, the good old corny example of the nuclear power station and how incomprehensible it all is, you just don't care. You say, why should I have an opinion about reactor safety when half the engineers argue with the other half about what the word safety means? And anyway, they'll sort it out themselves. As long as I get electricity out of the wall when I want it, don't bother me about where it comes from. Let the eggheads handle the problems of science and technology. I've got enough on my plate between when I get up in the morning and when I go to bed at night without having to worry about science and technology. Well, if that turns you on. But you're in the bind, whether you like it or not. Technology is a life support system. It puts the food on your supermarket shelves, runs the systems in your home, creates jobs and gets rid of them, cures you when you're sick, gets you to work, runs the water supplies. Sooner or later, all that high-level technology stuff filters down to everybody. And that's why what we do with science and invention next matters so much. And over recent years, people have become increasingly concerned about that, maybe because technology is producing problems that can no longer be solved as easily, or because the technological network is now so wide that we're vulnerable to the smallest kind of failure, like a frost in Brazil, and suddenly coffee is too expensive to drink. And things aren't as simple as they used to be. Back in the old days, when there was no third world, you wanted something, you took it. Not anymore. You have to earn the money to pay for it now. And once upon a time, the future was just onwards and upwards. Now, we don't even know if we can go on expecting a rising standard of living. And more, at the heart of questions and problems like that, is technology. And what places like this will do for us.
On the Cup of Joe radio show. I'm your not-so-humble host, Joe Vecchio, voice of the working man, voice of the radical middle, voice of those who have been unvoiced by the anti-worker policies of the Bush administration and its corporate allies. Once again, the URL for the site is cupojoe.blogspot.com, and the email address is joevec@bellsouth.net. And welcome to all my friends listening in on rantradio.com and to all those listening in my archives at the whiterosesociety.org. Ben Birch, my good friend, hosting my archives there. That little piece I just played came out almost 30 years ago, mid-late 70s. It was from a television series called Connections by James Burke, and that was Mr. Burke himself. And basically what that was, it was a BBC documentary about how we look at history sometimes differently from what it really happened. And I don't want to go into too much detail about it, but basically it was about how one thing didn't necessarily lead directly to another thing, but how one invention was really the result of other things happening, like how looms and the computer are related, or how the carburetor from the car got invented because of perfume spray bottles, because that's what basically a carburetor is, a perfume spray bottle. A lot of people aren't aware of that. I wasn't aware of that until I saw the series. The thing that he was talking about, you know, Rick is still having a little throat difficulties there, but he's all right. The thing he was talking about at the beginning, the thing that went off so much by euphoria as rocket fuel, was the moon launch, Apollo 11, and the nuclear power plant, what he was talking about at the end. And before I continue on with that, because I've always kind of viewed things from a large picture. And there's a lot of Democrats and a lot of left-wingers out there who view things from a very, very small detail picture. In sports terms, again, every time the Republicans take a five-yard loss, they cheer crazy because they figured, you know, yay, we're finally winning, where things are going, they're moving back with you. And then they'll throw an 80-yard bomb and score a touchdown on the next play while we're busy celebrating. You know, grow up, people. You have to look at much longer vision, and you have to look at a much bigger picture than you're used to. 36 people voting against Alberto Gonzalez doesn't mean a damn thing. He still got in. And you can sit there and claim moral victory after moral victory, but it doesn't mean anything if you're not winning. But a lot of the things that are going on in politics, to get onto the subject I wanted to talk about, a lot of things that are going on with the politics are a result of our relationship with technology. And I look at human history, and you look back for it, and human civilization began because of the plow, because of an ability to make more food, enough food that we didn't have to support just people who were growing the food. We could support craftsmen and other people. That's when human civilization began. And Egypt was the first of the really great civilizations, and in fact, Connections talked about that. Excuse me. It was all because of the plow, because the plow gave them a food surplus. And really, the basics of civilization haven't changed. How we produce that and how we produce the things that make life comfortable have improved and changed. But the basic technology is still the same in the sense that you have to grow enough food for everybody and you have to put things together in a way that makes life more comfortable, getting people back and forth to work, getting them medicines that help cure them. And it's gotten very complicated using the computer. And when James Burke did this documentary, there were no computers like this in homes. The computers they had were still punch card computers that stored a lot of information, but they really couldn't do a lot. Now, computers have the ability to do so many different things, like getting my voice out to you over the radio. You young kids, you people who are 17, 18, 19 years old, who've never lived, who can't remember a day when there weren't a computer, have no idea what the situation was like before then. And Burke was talking about a rate of change, a rate of novelty that happened very quickly in 75 and 76. My God, compared to these days, they were moving in a snail's pace because everything changes quickly here. You know, they'll all go into a big blather about something, and then 2 days later they're talking about something completely different. And how does that affect us? Do you guys have any feelings? Because I think that's how some Democrats are looking too. They're looking very, very short term, and the Republicans are looking long term. How do you feel about this sort of thing? You got an opinion? Anybody? They're both pointing at each other. They're like,
This is a heavy subject.
Yeah, it is.
What we do know is that history is organic,
mm-hmm.
and it does kind of play out the way John Lennon said it once, where it's life is what happens when you're busy making other plans.
Yeah,
you know, we don't really know what each event will trigger down the line. But sure as hell, it's going to trigger something.
Well, here's what I think. This is to make my predictions, if you can call it that, because it's really not a prediction because I can't predict specifically how it's going to happen or even when it's going to happen. But I think what's going on now, the thing that's going on in Iraq and the thing that's happening economically in this country and in Europe and in Asia is eventually going to lead to a single global political community, the one world government that everybody's so afraid of here in this country, that everybody gets scared shitless. In fact, I'm sure there are people across the world who are scared shitless of that. And that would be such a huge thing, a single economy, because we're already moving in towards that. In fact, this is something that President Bill Clinton talks about. He says, we live right now in a very interdependent society where technology, everything that happens in technology affects everybody. The Iraq war, because it affects oil, and the production of oil affects the way people think about, you know, how much expense it is to move things back and forth. And it's more than just the obvious straight-out effects. When the Internet was created by government people who were just looking for a way for computers to talk to each other to help them more organize their information. And what's it turned into? A great way for people to get porn, you know, and B, a way for people to communicate.
We need a laugh track right there.
We need a laugh track. I don't have a laugh track. But it takes off in different ways. I'm sure when Al Gore and the other politicians who made the technology available to the public, and when Al Gore talks about creating the Internet as we know it today, which was his exact quote, not inventing, That's exactly what he's talking about. He didn't say that he was personally responsible for putting it all together, but he was responsible, along with some other politicians, for making that technology available to the general public. And, of course, that technology became available because of the space program, because they were looking for ways to miniaturize things and make things smaller. And if you look back in the 60s and the 50s, the computers they had were just friggin' used. They took up the size of buildings. And now the power you have in your little Casio watch there has more computing power than the computer that they used on the Apollo spacecraft to land the craft.
No, apparently you can't even ship, at one stage you couldn't even ship apples overseas because they violated the too fast, too powerful computer rules.
And now
I guess they've had to change that. But you know, it's interesting what you say. It's the technology has democracy built into it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, once that technology spreads out to enough people, you know, once you have Windows occupying 95% of the world, right, and you have computers available across the world, a lot of things are going to happen.
And my buddy Aaron would be pulling his hair out at that statement. Aaron from the Election Reform Guy, you haven't met him, from the Election Reform Group, you haven't met him, but he's a huge Mac person and a Linux person. He hates Windows.
Well, see, that's democracy too.
But the thing about it is, it's not really democracy if something like Windows can dominate the market.
Well, it does now, but you see, Windows is scared to death of the Linux or the Unix systems because it's an open platform.
Right.
People can come in and they can make adjustments to your system anytime they want to.
Right.
That's the democratization of the thing. Also, the internet.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that I can communicate with Malaysia or China or Europe or any number of chat rooms around the world means that you can't hold back. You can't really censor the information like you did once. I mean, it'd be very clear that it would have been possible to censor what's happening in Iraq. They tried very hard with the embedded reporters and all of that sort of thing.
Right.
But stuff is coming out from various sources.
And the people who know.
And you will learn. And they now have to deal with shutting that down or discrediting it or whatever. It's all internet
stuff.
Well,
yeah, they're trying to discredit it. That's what they're doing because they can't stop it technologically speaking. That's like with a politician. I don't know who shot Kennedy, but whoever it is, whoever was behind it, and I don't believe it was just Lee Harvey Oswald, but whoever was behind it, they wanted to stop certain things that Kennedy was planning on doing. If he wasn't involved with that, then they probably wouldn't have bothered with it. But that can be very messy and a very difficult business. Now you want to assassinate somebody, you can assassinate them politically. That's what they did with Bill Clinton. That's what they did with Al Gore. That's what they did with John Kerry. You know, it's a political assassination. It's humiliating them out of power. And you know, that causes the same kind of repercussions as if somebody put a bullet through their head. And
why doesn't that happen in reverse? I mean, I think that,
because we don't
John
think that
Kerry
way.
Has done a lot less than George Bush.
Mm-hmm.
That should be humiliating.
Well, yeah. But because we don't think that way. Because like we talked about in the last segment, the Republicans want to go above and beyond the rules. The rules don't apply. It's just something for them to get around. And we still value the process. We value the process of government. We value the process of how things get done. We value that more than individual people, although we certainly have our heroes like Franklin Roosevelt and Kennedy and Harry Truman and stuff like that. But what we value is the rule of law. And the Republicans are not interested in that. Rule of law basically means they rule and we follow the laws. Yeah. Or like George Bush's ownership society. Who gets to own what in the ownership society? You know, it's basically they own us. But I know it's tough because we only have about 5 more minutes to talk about this sort of thing. But technology is going to supersede, I think, the politics in the long run. Because not only just what you're talking to people in Malaysia and things like that, but also the fact that you get to know these people.
Yeah, right.
And that makes a huge difference. I'm an anime fan. I like Japanese cartoons. I have since I was in Japan in 85, 86 when I was in the infantry. You were in Japan too, but you didn't see any of the anime.
Oh yeah, I did.
You did. Okay.
Yeah, I did.
But you obviously didn't become as big a fan of it as I did because I started writing about it and putting together newsletters and eventually formed a convention for it.
Oh really?
Yeah. But the thing about it is, anime is now mainstream. You see it on Cartoon Network. You know, you see it talked about in serious publications now. And it's a riot. And it's a completely foreign thing. It's something that you would never have thought about 20 or 30 years ago. Part of it was because of fans like myself and others who kind of paved the way to show that these things could be popular in the States to get them over here. But it's a completely different cultural thing. The way the Japanese think and the way they have the feel of their animation is very different from the way it has been in America. And it's not like it hadn't been on American shores before. I mean, there have been Japanese cartoons in America since 1962 with Astro Boy. But now it's just becoming much more and more available to people. And it gives them a different point of view on life. And I think eventually that's going to be more important. Just like culturally speaking, one of the things that the Europeans and others talk about, they love Americans, they just can't stand what the government is doing. One of the things I love about America is the idea that we like to have fun doing things. And our music, our movies, our culture in that sense, our sports, really affect other people. And or have more effect on other people than our military does. I mean, we think we can bomb Iraq into submission, but if we wanted to take over Iraq, you know, just inundate them with our products, you know.
That's true. Or actually, the culture, because it's more the culture,
yeah.
the feeling of Americans. Everybody loves coming here, visiting here, even settling here. You know, they want to. America is a great place,
right?
But when the fascism of the government and the corporations began to lean so heavily on other countries and their cultures and try to. I mean, I when I was overseas, I got to tell you a story. One of my clients was Kellogg's. And in Malaysia at that time, in Singapore, they didn't eat cereal for breakfast. They used it to make cookies for the special events, for the special holidays. But he said, and we told him that. We said, well, they eat dim sum or they eat congee, which is a rice porridge. And he says, well, we'll just have to change that. It says, we will make them eat cereal for breakfast. And it's when that kind of fascism or that kind of thinking comes into play where you don't respect what the other people are.
You don't try to turn it towards your audience. You try to make your audience like what you give them.
Then I think you get a lot of resentment.
Sure. I don't blame them. How would we feel if the situation were reversed? You know,
absolutely.
If somebody came in here and say, you're going to watch nothing but Japanese cartoons. You know, and you're going to watch Japanese game shows, and you're going to, you know, do this and that and this and that and that and this, you know. And we wouldn't like it. How would we feel if some other country thought we were a threat to their existence, and we're more of a threat to most countries than Iraq ever was, that's for sure. But how would we feel if somebody felt, well, you may not be a threat now, but you will be a threat in the future. Let's just go ahead and do a little preemptive strike on our own. Another country that would have that has George Bush listed as a war criminal. Would we be like a team of commandos coming in somehow, if they can do it, which they probably couldn't, but assuming it was possible, coming in there and kidnapping him and taking them back to their country for a trial. We wouldn't like it one little bit. Shit, even I wouldn't like that much, even though I think George Bush is a war criminal. I just think we have to use our own legal process to turn him over. And I hate to say it, but we got to bring this to a close here.
It's been good, Jeff.
Yeah. You know, it always happens when we get into these conversations. Clay and Rick, thank you for joining us on the show. Rick, you'll be here for next Thursday, hopefully.
Next week.
Clay, you're always welcome to join us, too, if you want to come down.
I appreciate it.
You came down here because you wanted to see how the show operates, and now you see how the show operates.
Yeah. Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
All right, everybody. This is Joe Vecchio from the Cup of Joe Radio Show, and I will see you on Thursday. Till next time, bye.
But Joe, I crave a plate of Dave. Oh, in a jar of John, don't put anything on. I'll chug a jug of George, I'll sip a mug of Doug with the creamer of Steve. How many more does that leave? Give me a pot of Scott, heat up a pan of Stan, throw in a handful of Dick, that'll do everything. Open a can of Dan, make a meal of Sam, but don't give me no mug, cause what I really want's a cup of
The Cup of Joe Radio Show has been recorded live at the fabulous Studio Al in Decatur, Georgia, and has been produced by Jove Enterprises, Incorporated.
Joe Vecchio, the host of the Cup of Joe radio show, is a production of Mr. and Mrs. Vecchio of Brooklyn, New York.
A plate of Dave, creamer of Steve, a mug of Doug, a cup of...